Good morning. Today's speaker, Orin J. Sofer, teaches meditation and communication nationally. He is a member of the Spirit Rock Teachers Council. Some of you know about Spirit Rock over in Marin County. He holds a degree in comparative religion from Columbia University. He's a certified trainer of nonviolent communication, or NVC. He's a course trainer at Mindful Schools and a somatic experiencing practitioner for trauma healing. I met Orin 3.5 years ago when he and Donald Rothberg co-led a week-long meditation retreat workshop titled Wise Speech. It combined mindfulness meditation and nonviolent communication, or NVC. I'd had the good fortune to attend a number of NVC seminars in previous years, and as a longtime meditator, I was really excited at the potential in combining the two techniques of mindfulness meditation and NVC. That workshop led by Orin and Donald was one of the very best such experiences in my life. Among the many benefits I got from it, one of the exercises that Orin led goosed me into an unexpected burst of creativity in my own writing. The essay that resulted landed me a third prize in the very first writing contest I ever entered, so I'm delighted to have the chance to say thank you, Orin. Orin has since then worked up some of his material from his workshops into a book that was just published last November. Say What You Mean, A Mindful Approach to Nonviolent Communication. And, of course, there are copies for sale afterwards if you're interested. I've only been a member here at UUCB for the last 2 years. I wandered up the hill, like many others, in search of social activism in the wake of the 2016 elections. I found this marvelous community, and I haven't left since. Among my very, very first experiences here was a workshop in NVC led by Nancy Kahn of Bay NVC. Some of you probably remember in February of 2017, Dialoguing Across Differences. Were any of you, any of the others of you there for that? It knocked my socks off. For me, that workshop here was yet another powerful affirmation of just how powerful NVC can be in so many areas of our lives, you know, personal, work, and so on, but also just how it can turbocharge our effectiveness in social activism. So to be able to introduce Orin here today is for me a really beautiful closing of a loop. It's an honor and a pleasure to introduce Orin Sofer and his speech on living our values, speaking and listening with awareness. Let's give Orin a big welcome.
Well, thank you, Karen. Thank you, Gloria. And thank you to each of you for coming out this morning.
This will wait.
Very happy to be here with you and to share a little bit about these tools that Karen was talking about bringing our spiritual practice into our life through speech, communication, and more broadly speaking, relationship. So I started meditating when I was quite young. I was about 19, going through some of the very ordinary challenges of young adulthood, falling out with friends, getting mixed up in things that I won't mention. My parents were getting divorced. So, you know, it was a time of challenge that can be quite typical for that period in our lives. And I started reading about mystical traditions, contemplative practice, and I was quite taken with the possibility of transformation that these practices that I had never been exposed to or heard of before offered. So I ended up actually traveling halfway around the globe to India and living in a Buddhist monastery for a number of months and starting to practice Buddhist meditation. And in that practice, I found a very powerful system to look within and start to understand some of the stress and difficulty and suffering that I was experiencing, and getting some tools to begin to heal some of the wounds that I was carrying. And what I found was that these practices helped not just with the personal stress and difficulty that I was facing in my life, but also started to help me to understand some of the things that separate and divide us in life, particularly here in the United States. Growing up in this culture, I had unconsciously internalized some of the messages and beliefs that our society sends around the dominant group, whether it's being white, being male, being heterosexual. I was raised in a very progressive, liberal, socially conscious Jewish family. And so I had been instilled with, values of democracy, respecting people for who they are, not judging people based on the color of their skin or their sexual orientation. And yet I still saw some of those forces from society in my mind coming up. As I started practicing meditation, seeing them more clearly, and the meditation started to give me a way to be more aware of the bias and the unconscious racism that I had internalized. So this journey of meditation led me to study religion in my undergraduate studies, and eventually to go and live at a meditation center in rural Massachusetts. That's the sister center for Spirit Rock here in Marin. So about 5 or 6 years into my kind of personal journey with meditation, what I found was that the values of peace, compassion, patience, kindness, all of these beautiful things that I was actually feeling and experiencing in my silent personal meditation practice would somehow magically evaporate as soon as I got into a disagreement with somebody or an argument. Even as something small like how to cut the carrots, I was working in the kitchen at the Insight Meditation Society. And if anyone's here has worked in a kitchen before, you know that it can get fairly intense around things like how you cut the vegetables or how long the broccoli is steamed. So I noticed very quickly that there was a disconnect. And this stood out to me, in particularly because of my Jewish upbringing and the emphasis that my parents placed on social action and bringing religion and spirituality into our life and into society. And so, it left me with this question, this sense of, if this meditation stuff is going to actually be meaningful in my life, if this is worthwhile for anything, it's got to show up in my relationships. It's got to be available in my conversations. Otherwise, what good is it? Right? It's great to be able to sit there with your eyes closed and meditate or contemplate. It's beautiful to be able to pray or to experience communion in the sacred space of our sanctuary or our home. But if we can't be connected to that sense of something larger than ourselves, whether you consider it the transcendent or the divine, if we can't be connected to our deepest values and intentions when we disagree with someone, when we're met with aggression, judgment, or even hatred, what good is our spirituality if we can't draw on it in those moments of challenge? So it was about that time, in my mid-20s now, that I came across the work of a man named Dr. Marshall B. Rosenberg. How many people here have heard of Dr. Rosenberg? Wonderful. So Marshall Rosenberg grew up in Detroit in the 40s, and he lived through, as a young boy, the first wave of race riots that happened in Detroit in the mid-40s, and they couldn't leave their house for several days during the race riots. Dozens of people lost their lives within a few blocks of his home. And this had a profound impact on him as a young child. He realized, he talked about it in later years, saying, this was a very important education for me. He learned that in this country, people might want to do physical violence to you because of the color of your skin. And as he continued to grow up in Detroit, he was the victim of anti-Semitism. He was beat up as a kid because of his last name, Rosenberg. His father's physical safety was threatened in the community. So again, he learned that people might want to harm you because of your last name or because of your religion. So these early experiences as a child planted in him a seed of a very potent question. And that question was, how come some people, when their needs aren't met, will resort to violence, whereas others are able to stay connected to compassion, and even more than that, some people take joy in giving and helping one another? What makes the difference? We're all human. We all have the same potential. So how come some people take such joy and pleasure in helping and giving, while others find themselves using violence to meet their needs, to protect their own well-being, or to serve and support their family or community? So through his own exploration, through his research and study with people like Carl Rogers, what he found was that the ways in which we think and speak play a large role in whether or not we will see violence as a viable strategy in life. And so he summarized the insights and learnings that he came to in this system or process called nonviolent communication. And he chose that name, nonviolent communication, for several reasons. First, to illustrate and point to this connection between language and the willingness to use violence. Because again, he saw the perceptions, the ways in which we think, shape how we view and relate to one another. So if I see you as being wrong, bad, or evil, then in this society, based on those concepts, you deserve to be punished. And it justifies using violence. Whereas if I'm able to see your humanity, to actually see what we share in common, the deeper needs that we all have as human beings, it changes my approach to how I will address behaviors that I see as problematic. So this is one reason he chose this name, nonviolent communication. The other reason was that he wanted to place this practice very intentionally and consciously within the tradition of social change of Gandhi and King, because he saw the essential role that language plays in social transformation. That if we are unable to transform the ways in which we think, the very consciousness that we carry, we will unwittingly end up recreating the same kind of oppressive systems socially that we're trying to transform. That the first step, or perhaps not the first, but an essential step in social change and transformation, is working on uprooting oppression and domination from our own consciousness. And so he saw this practice of nonviolent communication both as an inner transformation of our consciousness, as well as a tool for social change, for engaging with the systems and the institutions that structure our society. So I came across this work in my mid-20s, just as my meditation practice, I was starting to hit this kind of, you know, roadblock of how do I translate this stuff into my relationships, into my life. And what nonviolent communication gave me was a strategy, a tool to translate the values of my spiritual practice into my life, into my conversations, into my relationships at work, with friends, at home. So what I'd like to share with you today are a few kind of core trainings that I have found to be most useful in making this transition between our contemplative practice, our spirituality, and our relationships and conversations. These three trainings that I will share with you form the structure of my book, Say What You Mean, that Karen mentioned. But first, I just want to add one more thought of context here. And this is about the central role that communication plays in our lives as human beings, and why, for me, it's such a potent area for spiritual practice and transformation. So as human beings, we are deeply relational, social creatures. So everything in our history and our biology is expecting us to live in close-knit small communities of 100 to 150 people where we know everyone. This is how humans have lived for millennia. It's only really in the last 100 to 200 years that we have moved dramatically away from the sense of the village, the clan, the small community that for the vast majority of our evolution we have known. So we still carry in us this deep longing for connection, for belonging, for community. And it's our communication to a large degree that determines the quality of our relationships in our lives in every area, at home, with our family and our intimate ones, socially with our friends, even professionally. There have been, you know, studies that have been done, and the statistics show that, you know, a large degree of our professional success are the so-called soft skills of relationship and communication. So because of this central role that communication plays in our relationships and our lives, even one small change in our communication skills and habits can have far-reaching effects, because we're doing it all the time. We are communicating every day, all day long, in every area of our life. Right? Even when we're alone, we might be reading the news, so we're listening in a certain way. We might be on social media engaging. Even when we're by ourselves, there's that narrative, right? That inner voice of communication happening. How are we speaking to ourselves? How do we treat ourselves? Are we able to be skillful in our communication? Are we able to embody the values of kindness, forgiveness, patience, and understanding that we wish to bring into the world in how we relate to our own limitations and shortcomings? So communication is this kind of nexus of human life. And because of this, it's a potent area for transformation and learning. I want to read to you just a few paragraphs from the introduction to my book. And then I'll share with you these three foundational trainings that I have found to be so transformative and helpful in working with communication. So this is from the introduction. What we say matters. We've each felt the power that words have to heal, soothe, or uplift us. Even one caring remark can make the difference between giving up and finding the strength to face life's challenges. We each also know something of the great harm that can be inflicted through speech. Sharp words laced with anger or cruelty can break a relationship or burn for years. language can be used to manipulate and coerce on a mass scale, to fuel fear, war, and oppression, and to advance political agendas of genocide or terror. Few things so powerful are also so commonplace. Words are woven into the fabric of our lives. Your first love. Your first job. Your last goodbye to someone you love. Our beginnings and endings and the countless moments in between are punctuated by a play of words as we share our thoughts, feelings, and desires. The creation myths of many cultures and religions through time, East, West, and Indigenous, recognize the generative power of words, giving the potency of speech a key role in the beginning of the cosmos. Indeed, words have the power to shape our reality. As we think, so we perceive. As we perceive, so we act. Moreover, the teachings of all world religions reflect a universal understanding about the ethical implications of language, its potential for good or harm, and include moral guidelines around the appropriate use of speech. What we say matters, perhaps now more than ever. We live in times of great change, in which much is being asked of us. We live at a time when we are less and less able to listen and really hear one another in society. At a time when those with different views, beliefs, or backgrounds are once again so easily cast as the other. At this time when great forces of political, social, economic, and environmental change are sweeping the globe and intensifying our separation from self, others, and life, we need to learn how to speak and listen in a new way. So how do we do this? How do we start to shape this capacity that we've been endowed with for language that carries so much weight in our personal lives and in our social lives? So the work that I do integrates several different modalities and frameworks of understanding. Karen mentioned two of them, mindfulness practice and the insights from the Buddhist tradition of the mind and how our consciousness functions. Nonviolent communication, the work of Dr. Rosenberg. And then some training I have in healing trauma, which gives an understanding of the human nervous system. Called somatic experiencing, which was developed by a man named Dr. Peter Levine. And so what I found is that these three together offer a very powerful vehicle for transforming our communication. So I want to share with you these three principles or steps of training and give you a little example or tool that you can integrate into your life right away, starting today, so that if we never see each other again, hopefully you leave here with something concrete that you can begin to use to find some bridge between your values and your relationships and conversations. So the first foundation of mindful communication, of living our values, is being able to do something that I call leading with presence. This is just training in awareness. So communication, conversation, fundamentally is about creating understanding, right? Whether we are trying to connect personally, deepen our relationship, or we are on a project trying to build a bridge or design a system, fundamentally, when we communicate, we're sending and receiving messages. The currency of communication is understanding. If you want to understand anything, you need to be here first. It's so obvious, we overlook it. if we are not present, no communication happens. Have you ever had the experience of saying something to someone who's just several feet away from you and they're watching TV, they're on their phone, or they're daydreaming? Their ears are working perfectly. You're speaking the same language, but it's like they didn't even hear you. You know what I'm talking about? So if there's no presence, if there's no awareness, communication doesn't happen. And vice versa, when someone's actually really present, when someone's giving us our full attention, we feel it, right? It sends a message that says that I value our relationship, I'm interested in what you have to say. It starts to create the conditions for us working together and building something, whether it's our relationship or the shared goal that we have in common. So to lead with presence means that before anything else in a conversation, before what we want to say, how we're feeling, what happened, we just show up. That we trust the simplicity and the power of our own presence to begin to lay the conditions for understanding. It means that we begin from a place of awareness and that we train ourselves to learn how to come back again and again during a conversation to that place of being aware and grounded in ourself, connected to what matters to us. There's a lot working against this in our society and culture today. We live in a time where the pace of modern life is completely unnatural for our biology. The number of demands on our attention and our physical body in the course of one day are beyond what our organism evolved to do. We are required to process an amount of information and tasks, most of us at least, living in modern society, that we were never designed to do. And so we begin to expect things to operate on a certain pace that's unnatural. Our nervous systems themselves are becoming entrained to the pace of our devices, of instant gratification, push a button, make it happen, right? And so that conditioning of faster, better, more efficient, give it to me now, starts to show up in our relationships. Have you noticed this? The level of impatience that others experience or that we experience internally when we're talking to someone, because everything's moving so quickly. Presence means that we have the willingness to actually slow down, to connect with what it is to be alive and on the planet. Conversation's an organic process. It's not an app, right? People don't function that way. It takes time to hear one another. We have to breathe. We have to listen. We repeat ourselves. We double back on something. So leading with presence means working against this cultural force of the instant gratification and the intense pace of our society. We also live at a time where we are more and more disconnected from our bodies. You know, the destruction of our environment is one of the most heart-rending results of our disconnection from the sense of embodiment. The very reality that we depend on the air and the water and the soil to survive. So again, in part due to technology, and the amount of time that we spend looking at a screen in virtual reality. The emphasis in Western culture on the cognitive realm over the emotional or the physical intelligence. The emphasis on the future, planning, always getting to the next thing. Even the very physical designs of our world. Everything is straight lines, going ahead, looking in the future. takes us out of our body. Presence means that we come back into our physical form, that we have access to the wisdom of our emotions, of our intuition, that we're able to access the sense of stability that comes from being in our body. Last, in terms of the barriers that we are working against in order to lead with presence in our conversations, we live at a time in which our attention is increasingly fragmented, in part due to the pace and the volume of tasks that we have to manage, but also just simply due to our dependence on technology, to advertising, to the media. Our attention is getting pulled in so many different directions in any given moment. And this is none of these are personal failings, right? These are cultural forces that are much larger than any one of us individually. There are billions of dollars every year going into persuasive design on our devices, learning more and more how to shape our behavior, how to get us to stay engaged with a particular screen or website or application. So leading with presence means, in a very real way, reclaiming the authority over our own awareness. Saying that I'm the one who's going to determine where I place my attention and how long it stays there, rather than these external forces. So, and this is just some of this training of leading with presence. The first section of my book goes into this in much more detail, offering a whole kind of progression of training in first how to establish more awareness in ourself, and then how to bring it into a conversation, right? Because as I was saying, it's one thing to be aware, clear, grounded when we are doing our contemplative practice in the sanctuary of our own home or our community. It's another thing to be able to do it with another human being in a conversation. And there are specific tools for being able to lead with presence. So I want to share two of them with you right now. So the first, and you can try this right now as you're listening, is to see if you can feel a little bit of the sensations in your body. So you might feel the weight of your body sitting on the chair or your feet on the floor. You might just feel the sensations in your hands, the warmth or coolness or heaviness there. So can you do that just for a moment right now? Can you stay connected to your body just a little bit as you hear me continue to speak? As I continue, see if you can keep a little bit of awareness with yourself, just feeling your body. Sensations don't exist in the past or the future. If we are aware of a sensation, we are, for that moment, present. So this is one way that we can begin to learn how to lead with presence, is just feeling our body a little bit, drawing on that. Another very powerful tool for leading with presence, there's a few more seats over here if you'd like, yeah, is the practice of pausing. Just taking a short pause in the flow of your speech like I just did. It doesn't need to be long. But one pause can change what you say next. It can make the difference between saying something that's hurtful, that's going to take a lot of time and energy to clean up, and having the restraint to just go, okay, maybe I'm not going to say that. So you can practice with this too as a way of leading with presence. Just a short pause to consider, what do I actually want to say? Where do I want to come from? So on the back table there, and also over here near my books, I brought some postcards. These are free. You can take as many as you like. And each of them has a little teaching on it from my book. And so one of them says, pause. One breath can change what you say next. So you can take this and put it by your phone or on your refrigerator or next to your computer, right? How many times do you wish you would have paused before hitting send on that email or text message, right? So post this around your house. It can save you a lot of grief. So this is leading with presence. I want to tell you just a very brief story about the power of this practice of leading with presence. So one of the things I do, in addition to speaking and leading workshops and day-long programs, is I teach retreats where we move back and forth from silence contemplative practice to interactive communication practices. Karen was talking about this at the beginning. That's how we first met. And actually, we're teaching, Donald and I are teaching that retreat again here in Berkeley this summer. And I'll say more about that at the end. So I was teaching a retreat in New Mexico this past summer, and at the end of the retreat, we passed the microphone around, and each person was just sharing a few reflections on what they got out of the week, what they were leaving with. And so the microphone comes around to this one gentleman, mid-70s, he's from Colorado, kind of a cowboy type. He'd been pretty quiet the whole week. So I was sort of interested, you know, what's this guy taking away? And so he takes a long pause before speaking. And he says, you know, what I realized this week is that my wife is the person I talk to the most, but talk with the least. I'm going to change that when I go home. That's the power of leading with presence. It opens that space of genuine mutuality. We really start to see one another. And that's the basis of dialogue, right? If we can't do that, how can we have a conversation? So this is why leading with presence is the first and most essential foundation for effective conversation and communication. So showing up, being present, gets us on the map, right? It's like now we're actually on the playing field. Now what? So the next foundation, the next most important thing in a conversation is our intention. Where are we coming from? What's motivating or animating how we relate, what we say, how we listen? Intention is perhaps the single most powerful and transformative ingredient in a dialogue. It determines that the whole direction of the conversation. Certain linguists have done studies and have proposed that upwards of 90% of our communication is not in the words. I don't remember the actual breakdown. It's like 60 or 70% is body language, facial expression, gesture, and then another, you know, 15% is tone of voice. And it's our intention that's animating and shaping all of that nonverbal communication. Right? So when you're in a conversation with someone and they're saying one thing with their words, maybe they're even smiling, they're making eye contact, but their body language is saying something else, or your intuition is telling you, this person doesn't like me. Or they're trying to pull one over on me. Which do you trust? Do you trust the words or do you trust that body language? Right? We trust that deeper signal. So this is why intention is so important. And it's often not emphasized in communication training. So what happens a lot of the time with communication techniques is that we learn all of these fancy listening skills and I statements and different ways of changing our words. But what's in here hasn't shifted. So we're still trying to be right. We're still trying to control or manipulate the situation. We just have much fancier ways of doing it, right? Have you ever had a conversation with somebody who maybe went to a communication training and they come home and they start saying things and all high and mighty about how they're making I statements and, you know, and it's just like you're just doing the same thing in a different way. Or maybe you found yourself doing that. This is because communication is fundamentally not about what we say. It's about where we're coming from inside and the quality of connection or understanding we're able to create with the other person. So the training here that I teach is to come from curiosity and care. To learn how to have this as a baseline, as a default. In my conversations, how can I actually get curious? What's true for this person? How can I understand them from their point of view? To cultivate that quality of empathy. This genuine intention to understand. When someone really feels and trusts that we are trying to understand them, they can stop defending themselves, right? Something relaxes inside. And when they feel understood, they have more space to listen to us. So to come from curiosity and care. So the care part doesn't mean that we like everyone. Let's be real, right? We have our preferences. You know, we know like who our people are, who we really connect with. We have the same vibe. Others were like, you know, God bless you, I love you, but I don't want to spend my life with you. Right? That's the reality of being human. What coming from care means is that we're connected to our heart. We're in touch with what we care about, our deeper values, and that we're not harboring hostility or ill will towards others. Right? Dr. King gave a very beautiful teaching on the teaching from the New Testament of love thy neighbor, where he says Jesus didn't say like your neighbor, right? He said love your neighbor. There's a difference. This is what I mean by to come from care, that we are connected to that deeper level inside of what matters to us. So I want to tell you a story about the power of intention in conversation and relationship, of coming from curiosity and care. So I came across this story while I was doing some research for my book. There's a man by the name of Darryl Davis, who's an author, actor, and jazz musician. Darryl grew up overseas, African-American man, moved to this country when he was 9 or 10. So he was not privy to the racism that is so deeply embedded in our society. And so they lived in rural Massachusetts, or just outside of Boston, in Massachusetts, when they moved to the country. And he joined the Boy Scouts, the Cub Scouts, and they were marching through the town. And as they were marching, he's the only African-American kid in the Cub Scout troop, people in the town, some of the people started throwing rocks and bottles and fruit at him. And the scoutmaster had to actually, you know, protect him and take him off. And his father had to explain to him why people were throwing these things at him. And he said, but how can they hate me if they don't know me? He couldn't understand why someone could hate you because of the way you looked. So this planted in him, similar to Marshall, a very powerful question. This, how can you hate me if you don't know me? So later in life, he's a jazz musician playing with a band. He's playing in a bar in southern Maryland. And the way he describes it, he's playing in a white bar. And at the end of one of the sets, this white man comes up to him and says, you know, you play pretty good for a black man. Almost as good as Jerry Lee Lewis. So for those of you who don't know jazz music, Jerry Lee Lewis is a white piano player. So Darryl is kind of taken aback, kind of, you know, looks at him and says, you know, that's kind of interesting because I know Jerry Lee, he's a friend of mine. And Jerry Lee Lewis learned to play the way he plays from black musicians, black blues musicians and boogie-woogie piano players. And so this white guy's kind of taken aback. He says, oh, I didn't know that. So Darryl, who's very kind of personable, starts chatting with this guy, and they sit down and have a drink. They start talking. Turns out this guy's a member of the Ku Klux Klan locally. This comes out in the conversation. So they develop a relationship. And Daryl goes back and they continue talking. Daryl just really wanting to understand this person. How can you hate me if you don't know me? Not trying to change his mind, not, you know, arguing or denigrating his views, but just genuinely being curious, asking questions, listening. And over time, through dialogue, through patience, through kindness and respect, this man's views begin to change. He starts to actually ask Daryl, well, what do you think? Just through the force of his kindness and curiosity. So this sparked in Daryl an interest in understanding the KKK and the members of the KKK in this area. So he took up a project to write a book about it. And through this one relationship, this man introduced him to many members of the organization in the area. Through conversation and dialogue, Daryl was responsible for 40 or 50 members of the KKK leaving the organization. Several of them gave him their hood and robes. And indirectly, through these conversations and relationships, over 200 members of the KKK left the organization in Southern Maryland. The whole organization collapsed. Simply through the power of friendship, curiosity, and dialogue. This is the power of our intention. It can transform a whole conversation, the whole tone. So can we get curious? Can we just remember this intention to genuinely understand? What's going on for you? What's important to you? Can I listen? One way of doing this is even using a short phrase. Like, let me see if I hear you. Let me see if I'm getting it. Let me see if I'm understanding. Saying something like that can remind us of this intention and signals to the other person that we are trying to listen. So this is the second foundation and step of training, to come from curiosity and care. And the postcard for this that's on the back there, it says, learning begins with the willingness to not know. We have to recognize that there's something I can learn from this person, perhaps, to get interested. So, I said there were three trainings, right? Three steps. Lead with presence, come from curiosity and care. So, I've covered two-thirds of the model, generally. Notice I haven't said anything about your words or what you say. Again, because so much of communication is about the internal state, where we're coming from, what we're communicating with our presence and our body language and our tone of voice. So the third training starts to look at how we actually speak and listen, how we shape our attention. What do we focus on in a conversation? And this is where Dr. Rosenberg's training of nonviolent communication provides a really robust form to shift how we see things in relationships and conversations. So the training that I offer here is to focus on what matters, to learn how to train our attention to perceive and discern the actual aspects of our experience that will help us to understand one another. And this is the training of nonviolent communication that Dr. Rosenberg developed, which includes four parts to be able to make clear and specific observations about our experience, about the world around us, to be able to identify how we actually feel about what happened, our emotions, or to hear someone else's emotions. And then most fundamentally, to know why. Why do we feel that way? We only feel things because there's something that matters to us. If we didn't care about it, we wouldn't be feeling any emotions about it. So what are the deeper needs that are connected in this situation? And last, how can we make a request in this moment that will move things forward? How do we work together? So these four components of nonviolent communication are observations, feelings, needs, and requests, or as I often like to say, what happened, how do we feel about it, why, what matters, what's important, and where do we go from here? So focus on what matters. What's most important in this moment to understand, to be aware of, to hear, to communicate? This is a very thorough training of retraining, actually, of our attention. Instead of focusing on our judgments, our beliefs, who's right or wrong, what should or shouldn't have happened, how often has being right helped you to be closer to someone? How often has winning an argument opened someone's heart to you or brought about the transformation you were seeking? Right? So regardless of who's right or wrong, is that actually useful in having a meaningful dialogue? Or is it more useful to think and speak in terms of what matters to us? Why this is important? What we're hoping for? What could have been going on for the other person and what's important to them? That's where we have the space to actually hear one another and develop common ground, is by focusing on what matters. When we can identify this deeper layer of our shared human needs and values, it opens the door to compassion and understanding and to more creativity and empowerment. So I'll end with one or two more stories about this ability to focus on what matters. So the central principle here that comes not just from Dr. Rosenberg, but from humanistic psychology, from the work of Abraham Maslow and Carl Rogers, is this perspective on human life that says that part of what makes us human is that we all have certain basic needs. Not just needs for food and water and shelter, but we have relational needs for community, belonging, understanding, love, touch, empathy. And we have higher needs, needs for meaning, for purpose, for contribution, for peace, for transcendence. And that these needs that we have are what motivate us in life. That all of our behavior can be understood as an attempt to meet some underlying basic need. It may not be conscious. It may not be wise or successful. But just as a plant turns towards the light, human beings are trying in some way to meet our needs. This is the view, the perspective of humanistic psychology. So how does this apply to our lives? So one participant was at a workshop, heard this teaching, driving home in the car, reaches for a cigarette, and as they're reaching for the cigarette, they remember, okay, everything I do to meet a need. All right, if this stuff is true, then my wanting to smoke a cigarette is trying to meet some need. What needs am I trying to meet? Let's give this stuff a whirl and see if it works. So they think about it for a few moments, you know, well, I guess I want to relax. Yeah, I want to take my mind off things. Relax. I want a break. And as soon as they became aware of what they actually wanted at the deeper level, I want to relax, take a break. In that moment, they had crystal clarity. I've got far better ways of relaxing and taking my mind off of things than destroying my health by smoking. So on the personal level, this is the power of identifying what matters, our deeper needs. When we're aware of what's actually important to us, of why we're doing the things we're doing, we can start to actually evaluate. Is this the wisest choice? Is this working? Do I want to continue doing this? If we're unaware of the deeper needs behind our behaviors, we are bound to continue to repeat the same behavior without knowing why we're doing it. So on a personal level, individually, we can use this teaching to focus on what matters, to bring more choice and empowerment into our lives. Why are we doing the things that we're doing? On a relational level and on a social level, it's what opens the doorway to being able to hear one another and connect, and to work creatively. So in Boston, a number of years ago, there was a march on abortion rights, reproductive rights. And so there was a group that was pro-choice and a group that was pro-life. Sort of typical protest scene, picket signs, shouting, people on two sides. Somehow, during the demonstration, two women from the two different sides started talking. And one of them made a joke to the other saying, you know, we're not going to get anywhere just yelling at each other, right? This is accomplishing nothing. Why don't we get together for coffee? So out of this one conversation, a small group formed of women from the pro-choice side and the pro-life side. And they started meeting and talking about their views, about their values, about what mattered to them, why they wanted what they wanted. They developed relationships. They got to know one another, their families. Months go by. It was very interesting. None of the women in either group actually changed their views. There wasn't some aha moment, right? I see the light, you're right, I'm wrong. But what happened was, when the women in the pro-life group heard through their network that someone was planning to come to Boston to bomb an abortion clinic, they got together and talked about it. And they said, this is not okay. And they sent a message out that said, do not come. You are not welcome in our community. To me, that's a success. Because by focusing on what matters, the other side was human. They still disagreed. But they weren't willing to use violence to accomplish their goals. That's the power of these tools. Of leading with presence, coming from curiosity and care, and learning to focus on what matters, what's most important. Not just our views or disagreements at the deeper level. So thank you so much for your kind attention. I hope it's useful. So I want to just make a few announcements before we move into the Q&A. First and foremost, I have books for sale. I would love to share the fuller exploration of these teachings and practices with you. So if you'd like to pick up a copy, please feel free to. I'll hang out and be signing books afterwards for those who would like. There are also some materials on the back table about my teaching. With upcoming retreats and workshops. I live right here in Richmond, so I teach a lot here in the Bay Area at Spirit Rock locally. Two things that I would just want to highlight or point out that are coming up. So one, if you enjoy the way I present things and it's meaningful for you and you want to stay in touch, I would love that. And the best way to do that is through my email list. I send out two emails a month. Each one has like a link to an article I've written or a talk that I gave, and there's a clipboard on the back table. You have to print your email address clearly. This is a mindfulness practice. Capital letters, right? Okay, so if you want to stay in touch, when you sign up, it comes with a free guided meditation series and a short ebook that I wrote on contemplative practice. So that's one. Two, I'm teaching a 12-week online course based on my book. It just started. Registration closes tomorrow. Each session is live, but then they're also recorded, so if you miss one, you can always watch it later. There's scholarships available if finances are limited in any way, and there's some flyers for that on the back table. And then I won't go into all the other programs I have coming up. There are a number of them, but there are flyers on the back table. Retreats and training programs. Maybe there's one I will mention, actually, because I know many of you are deeply committed to social transformation, and might be interested in these tools of nonviolent communication. So a colleague of mine from Bay NVC, Roxy Manning, and I are teaching an 8-month intensive training program that meets one weekend a month here in Berkeley on nonviolent communication. And so there's some flyers on the back for that. It starts with a retreat that happens next month. So feel free to check those out, and then just other things you'll see if you want to look at the table. So let's use the time that we have left for any questions that you'd like to ask. Yeah, so this, oh, so you, I'll let you kind of, and please feel free to take some of these cards for yourself or friends or family.
I took a 6-week MVC course at the other UU church.
Wonderful.
And yeah, really helped me a lot.
Great.
And I feel like I'm just beginning to learn the steps, but I'm stuck kind of at this stage where I'm learning how to listen to myself, which I never did before during conversation. Like, I want to say something and I'll be like, okay, this is because I'm feeling like this, but I haven't gotten to the stage where what can we do about it?
Right.
Or even verbalizing that.
Right.
I'm still like at this stage, but it has helped my communication.
Wonderful.
So I was wondering, A, how do you move past this step? Because it's so enlightening to actually know that you're feeling things during conversation.
Right, right.
And two, this is not related to this example, but I've recently heard that there's all these different branches of MVC, the King's View and Gandhi is different, and people have been talking to me about different takes on the whole thing, and I wonder if you see any difference.
Thank you. So in terms of your first question, there are two things that I would suggest. So one, there's great power in being authentic and transparent in the moment about what's happening for us. So if what I'm hearing is that what's true for you is that you want to find a way to work together, but you don't know how. So I would encourage you right now during this phase to just say that. It can be incredibly liberating to say, here's what's going on for me. I want to find a way for us to understand each other and work together on this, but I'm not sure how to do that. I don't know where to go from here. Just be real about that. That's going to be a key to start to free up the pressure you're putting on yourself to have it all figured out or know what to say. So that's number one. Number two, start to practice a few, what you're talking about is making requests, being able to invite the other person into collaboration. Requests like, you know, could you listen to me for a little bit and hear what's going on for me? Or could you tell me more about where you were coming from and what's happening for you so that I can understand what matters to you? Or could we brainstorm different ideas that might work for both of us together? Those are three very simple requests. So come up with two or three requests that are generic enough that they'll apply in a lot of situations. Write them down. There's a list of these in my book in the back. And practice them. Memorize them so that they're right there at the tip of your tongue. Those are the two things that I would say. There are a lot of different views on nonviolent communication and how it's applied. I don't think I want to take the time to go into that because I think that fewer people would be interested in it in this context. For me, I will say that I very much am in line with Marshall's original intention for nonviolent communication as a tool for social change. It was very, very clear that he intended these tools to be used for transforming the institutions of our society. Yeah, you're welcome.
I'm a member of an international subculture called science fiction fandom. And in this culture, there is a word that science fiction has added to the English language. That word is grok.
Yes.
And it sounds like what you're presenting here very closely resembles the ideas presented by Robert Heinlein in his Stranger in a Strange Land. And the one thing that sticks a little bit is the use of non and un. To us, that is granting beingness to something that we don't really think exists.
Yes.
So what we try to do when we're being good science fiction people is we search for some kind of common ground.
Yes.
And sometimes the common ground can be as simple as we both talk like Southerners. And that we call mirroring. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, sure. Mirroring is a comes from psychological work and is a very important need for human beings, both in early stages of life, right, to develop empathy and emotional intelligence, as well as later in life to feel seen and heard. In terms of, I would agree with this perspective that you're presenting, that, you know, the negative of things, like don't do that. We talk about this a lot in nonviolence. You can't do a don't. Right? Things in nature don't exist in the negative. They only exist in the positive. The negative is an idea. But this word nonviolent communication, Marshall chose it very specifically because it's the word that was used by Gandhi and King, and it actually is the English translation of the word ahimsa or ahimsa in Sanskrit, which literally means non-harming. And the positive form of that, it includes a lot more. It includes a sense of reverence for life, a sense of gentleness, a deep connection with love, gentleness and care. So all of that is encompassed within the concept of nonviolence. There are other words that Gandhi used, like satyagrahi, right, soul force or truth force, that are part of nonviolence. So thank you for that comment.
Thank you. My wife and I have used NVC for about 9 years, and yeah, it works quite well. It's great. And actually, Roxy and her and I have studied before. We love her to death, so your event sounds attractive to me. And we've used the Offner, observations, mm-hmm. feeling, needs, and requests. Yes. And I have a request of you.
Wonderful. I will listen to the beauty in your heart, my friend.
That's often the only place it is. How do I make a request without trying to manipulate the person I'm requesting of?
Thank you. What a profound question. First, I just want to build on something that you said in the introduction to your question, which is that, you know, if you're here with a friend or your partner or wife, as you're saying, these tools are so powerful to share in a relationship, you know, to have together to work through difficulties. So if you are here with a friend or a partner, I would encourage you, and this is meaningful for you, it's like, oh yeah, that stuff makes sense. I would encourage you to learn more, whether it's buying my book or taking a class locally or something, because when you share that framework, when you hit a rough patch, it's like, okay, let's use the tools. And you can be awkward together. You can pull out the sheet and be like, here's my observation, here's my feeling. You can geek out on it. And it's like, there's none of that awkwardness because you know what you're both doing. So I just wanted to make sure to mention that. So what you are pointing to is at the heart of nonviolent communication, which is the foundational principle that all of our needs matter. We live in a world of separation where the cultural paradigm and the experiences that most of us have had in life teach us that when there's a difference or conflict, someone's going to win and someone's going to lose. And it's an either-or kind of situation. And what we're doing with these tools is exercising the creative capacity of our mind and heart to recognize maybe we could work together. Maybe we could understand each other enough to try to meet both of our needs. So how do we get there when we have that demand energy? I need you to do this. So there are two tools that I want to give you to practice with. The first comes directly from Marshall. So he encouraged, when we're in that place of being aware that this, the way this request is living in me is not as a request, it's a demand. So he said, ask yourself two questions. The first question you've already asked and you're clear on, which is, what do I want the other person to do? If we stop there, there's nothing to prevent us from using manipulation, blame, shame, coercion, force to get them to do what I want. So the next question to ask yourself, and be brutally honest with yourself, really look deeply. What do I want this person's reasons to be for doing it? Do I want them to do it because they fear me? Do I want them to do it because they think I'm right? Or do I want them to do it because they understand me? And because they understand the value that this will hold for me? If you can connect with that why inside, why you want them to do it, it will change how you approach the conversation. Because your intent will be not to get the person to do it, but to help them to understand. So this is one tool to work with. Okay? The other tool to work with is very similar to my response to your question, which is be transparent. Tell them, what I'm aware of is that I am completely fixated and attached to this strategy, and I'm trying to manipulate and control you to get my way. And I don't want to do that because I know, even if you agree, I'm going to pay a price later. Right? When we get what we want out of manipulation, control, blame, shame, there's a bill to pay later. So let the other person know where you're at. Say, here's where I'm at. This is what I want and why. And I'm not seeing other options. But I want to move past this and I don't know how. Can you help me? Exactly. Yes. Exactly. Bare your heart. Be real with them about that. So my friends, last question.
Thank you very much. This was one big aha experience. I wonder whether, are you familiar with Joan Blades, the living room?
Yeah.
Conversation.
We haven't met, we have met. She came to one of my events at Spirit Rock and we correspond some. Yes.
Oh,
wonderful
good.
Work.
I'm so glad. I think maybe you should go to Washington and to Israel and teach there.
Thank you. May it be so.
Thank you very much.
So, friends, thank you so much for coming. Again, please feel free to pick up a copy of my book or some of the other
and
materials.
And I'd just like
table.
To... Sorry. I'd like to put in a plug for one more event of Oren's. He is teaching that 6-day workshop in August, here in Berkeley.
That's right.
With Daniel Rothberg on wise speech. So I just wanted to make sure that you all knew that that's available to us too.
So that information is on my teaching schedule. There's not a separate flyer for it, but the dates are on the schedule and you can sign up on my website. So I'll hang out some if anyone wants to say hi.